Hello, I'm Jackson Miles. This is number 0407, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now, Mr.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0407. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll hear from TV writer-producer John Rogers as he talks about the job of TV showrunners.
Often the showrunner of a show is the person who created it. Sometimes you come in later and help show a show. But your idea is to first deliver the creative vision, the unifying creative vision of the show. Second, to manage all of the people, both the writers underneath you and the different departments that you're working with to get that creative vision. And then interface with the studio to just be able to handle the money. So to put the most amount of dollars on screen. So it's essentially synthesizing all of the different fields of television in one job, which is why there's not a lot of us wandering the earth, because, you know, there's a lot of reasons not to want that job, even if you're a great writer.
Chris Nyme, author of Two Sides to the Story, Living a Lie. He talks about his journey dealing with mental illness.
I started teaching in 1998. At the time, it came up on me with quite a surprise, but illness started to really take over my mind during those years. For 2 years, I had these terrible feelings that went from very, very low, depressive feelings where I'd come home and I was tired. I didn't have the energy and I couldn't do stuff, to maybe a few weeks later feeling an overabundance of energy and activity where I would stay at school till 10 at night and I was working like a fiend. It was wild.
Lloyd Kahn is the author of Small Homes, The Right Size.
The average American home, and probably the average Canadian home, is maybe the same as about 2,700 square feet. 5 or 6 years ago, the so-called tiny house movement began, which was getting down to maybe 200 to 300 square feet. The important thing about it was that things were getting smaller. And so our book is in between the typical large home and the tiny home. In the book, the homes are between 400 and 1,200 square feet.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0407 was 6-year-old Jackson Miles, son of Dan Miles, host of the Friends of Dan Music podcast, and also Every Friday with Dan and Olivia podcast. And by the way, that's not the only take we have, but some of the others we really can't play on family radio. Gee, I wonder where 6-year-old Jackson gets that from. Yes. Might have to have a talk with his dad. Anyway, thank you very much, Jackson, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And by the way, should also mention Dan's two shows. They're also available on patreon.com. Check them out. Anyway, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Two burglars who tried to steal cash from a bank ATM accidentally set their cash on fire. The Everett, Washington Fire Department responded to the Coastal Community Bank on a report of a fire alarm. A fire had started inside the business when someone used a cutting tool to access the ATM. Property damage has been estimated at over $35,000 for the burned cash, broken ATM, and building repairs. Detectives identify the two suspects as Eli Steen and Jason Kovar. Video surveillance shows that after setting the cash on fire by using a blowtorch, one of the men attempted to extinguish the flames by urinating on the money. However, his efforts did not pay off and they fled from the scene. Okay, how much liquid would you have to drink to be able to put a fire out by peeing? And in your mind, you'd have to think that you were built like a racehorse to accomplish that feat. Which, by the way, kind of brings us to this next story. A landowner was shocked to find a man having sex with a horse, according to police in Arizona. Is there anybody else I know in Arizona? Let me think. Anyway, the Yuma County Sheriff's Office said they have arrested 20-year-old Christopherson Maines after being caught on video having sex with the landowner's horse. According to a criminal complaint, the Yuma County Sheriff's Office responded to an animal cruelty case. Upon arrival, deputies met with the reporting party, who stated that the suspect had been caught having sexual intercourse with a horse on the property. Deputies were able to recover video evidence of the suspect. Maines was arrested and booked into the Yuma County Detention Center. He was charged with bestiality, indecent exposure, and animal cruelty. Now, I'm going out on a limb to say that I'm guessing the horse involved wouldn't have been impressed. I'm also guessing that Maines has a somewhat spotty dating record. Just saying. Okay, this next story I'm sharing to you as basically a public service. A Washington State woman returned to her car after work to discover a can of hairspray had exploded and embedded itself into the windshield. Carmen Ayers said she walked out of her work in Vancouver, Washington, and immediately noticed her windshield was severely cracked and there was an object embedded in it. At first I looked up because I thought maybe something fell, Ayers said, but then I noticed it was from the inside out. I was in shock, and then I realized what it was. Sure enough, it was my hairspray that exploded, and it had originally been in the back seat. It's a far distance to travel, and with a lot of force to break through the window, she said. Temperatures were in the low 90s, and that apparently caused the inside of her car to reach levels the aerosol can couldn't tolerate. It launched like a rocket, she said. Ayers posted a photo of the damage to Facebook with the line, "Tip of the day, don't leave your hairspray unattended in your car on a hot and sunny day." So, I guess that means now we have a growing list. First, don't leave your children in a hot car. Second, don't leave your pets in a hot car. Now, don't leave your hairspray in a hot car. Act accordingly. Now we have time for one more Stuff File news story in this section of the Stuff File news before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Workers at the Adams Township, Pennsylvania Road Department kept finding bags of empty vanilla extract bottles in the woods. "I've complained about it to police for a long time," said resident Greg Betant, "and I usually get a large garbage bag and I go down every year and pick up. The most I've picked up at one time was 110. So police put a trail camera in the area. In the same day, we got pictures of the subject throwing litter out, which was vanilla extract bottles, said Assistant Police Chief Robert Scanlon. An officer later saw the vehicle and pulled over 61-year-old Mary Ranker. Police say she was drinking vanilla extract from an 8-ounce bottle and had five more bottles in the car. By law, vanilla extract must contain at least 35% alcohol, and Ranker's blood alcohol level read 0.128%. Police say she's a recovering alcoholic. Boy, you better put the word recovering in quotes here. Seriously. Who bought vanilla extract from a supermarket instead of going to a liquor store. She was arrested and charged with DUI and littering. Okay, have you seen the prices of those tiny bottles of vanilla extract? That stuff is expensive. I mean, really expensive. I make bread, coconut bread with them, and they're expensive. You really have to be jonesing for alcohol to go the vanilla extract route. I'm wondering if the police are also investigating a possible string of rum cake disappearances. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? John Rogers is a screenwriter, television producer, and director, comedian, comic book writer, and also a friend. He's best known as the creator of several television series such as Leverage, The Librarians, and The Player. And by the way, I'm still upset that NBC canceled The Player. Anyway,
We often hear about the job of a showrunner on a television series, so I thought we'd have John on the program to give us a primer into what that gig is all about. John joins us on the line right now via Skype from California. Hi, John.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program. And yes, I do really miss the player.
So do I. Particularly the money for that back nine episodes. That would have been nice. Someday we will explain exactly what our giant conspiracy was on that show. My one frustration is we were about to do the episode that let you know that it was actually Charity Wakefield's character that was the mastermind behind everything. And it was like, ah! Just one more. I would have been happy if I just managed to pull that off.
Oh, wow.
So I know. It was a really cool show. But this is what happens when you do broadcast.
Absolutely.
So basically, if you want to talk about show running.
Yes.
So show running is basically like I always compare it to managing a baseball team. Is that essentially you're often the showrunner of a show is the person who created it. Sometimes you come in later and help show on a show. But your idea is to first, deliver the creative vision, the unifying creative vision of the show. Second, to manage all of the people, both the writers underneath you and the different departments that you're working with to get that creative vision. And then interface with the head office, basically the studio, and also, to just be able to handle the money, to know when you're over budget, under budget, where you can move the money, how to write episodes to effectively maximize your budget. So to put the most amount of dollars on screen. So it's essentially synthesizing all of the different fields of television in one job, which is why there's not a lot of us wandering the earth because, you know, there's a lot of reasons not to want that job, even if you're a great writer.
And it's a job that hasn't necessarily been around for a long, long period of time.
That's true. It's interesting. It really started in the 80s. There were showrunners, but they were more head writers. And there was a different dynamic between the networks and the studios, particularly, you know, before the days where the studios could own networks, where now everything is very sort of vertically integrated, where, you know, the creative vision of the showrunner or show creator becomes part of the show itself and promote people getting to follow. Like people follow Brian Fuller. Follow Joss Whedon, you know, people follow Shonda Rhimes. Like those are shows with a specific type of voice that comes from that showrunner. And I think also just the nature of the business changed from the 70s where you mostly freelanced everything you had. And, you know, my recollection may be imperfect for my time. I'm going off of other people talking about the business. But, you know, there were basically two full-time writers on a show, the story editors, and then everybody else freelanced. Now, you were on a show from, you know, from dusk till dawn, multiple years, and so everyone is contributing to the show over the course of a big chunk of their career. And that's a different kind of management challenge.
Is it also, to clean up this phrase just a little bit, is it also the one person that will be taking in all of the crap that comes from the suits and therefore it's not necessarily dispersed to those below?
Yeah, I think I actually mentioned it. My job as a showrunner, I was taught by my first showrunner, David Landsberg, is to take crap and distribute credit. You know, your job is to give everybody the room they need to do the best version of their job.
I came up with this idea of talking to you because I saw a recent article online talking. It was actually a forum that featured several showrunners talking about some of the worst ideas and advice they've gotten from those above, from those who are the suits. And I'm assuming you must have stories like that as well.
Yeah, you know what? I've been remarkably lucky, honestly, in that the projects I've tended to work on, one of the things I say constantly in the room, to the point where I had an NBC executive make fun of it one time, it was a friend of mine, she teased me about it, was the thing I say always is we have to be making the same show in our heads. We are all, if we're having a meeting and I suddenly feel like we're having an image of the show in our heads, I will actually stop the meeting and we will reset. Because that is how I see things go wrong, is when all of a sudden people have different images of the show in their head. I once consulted on a show that was in trouble. They were actually shut down on episode 5 and they brought me in to consult. And I said, you know, how did this happen? And the showrunner said, you know, the woman who's the big head on the poster, the lead of the show, she wasn't in the original pilot script. Somehow, just small note by small note, over the course of several weeks, it had just become a different show from what he had sold to what they made. And I compare it to, like, look, a television show is a long process. You make a lot of hours. And it's like crossing the Atlantic and missing by 2 degrees every day. It doesn't seem like much, But when you get across there, you're not in Paris, you're in Iceland. And that's just a different, yeah, that's a different place than you want to be. And so that's it. I don't have any really great horror stories. My friends certainly do, you know, but that's their stories to tell. And you can certainly find them online. But yeah, a lot of your job is everyone wants to make a good show. Everybody does. They really do. And a lot of your job is filtering out, okay, they want this show to be good. They're telling me something that is horrible. You know, why are they giving me this horrible note? It's often because they're trying to solve a problem that's actually there. They just came up with a bad solve.
Gotcha. One of the things, too, I noticed is especially nowadays with television shows that seem to have a serial type of storyline running through it, you might know as a creative person where you want the story to go, but that doesn't necessarily mean you know how you're going to get there. But you may be dealing with a studio that wants to know everything about it right up front, and you just haven't gotten there yet.
You know, there's an old von Moltke, the German general, once said, no plan survives contact with the enemy. And to a great degree, no show survives contact with actually getting on the air. We have a roadmap, every show that I do, where I know where we want to go in 5 years, but you get actors, you lose actors, the different chemistry happens, you know, infamously, orders get truncated or orders get expanded. You know, Lost, I think second season had this incredibly tightly clockwork, schedule that they had for the episodes. And then they got a bunch of episodes added. And they were like, well, this, you know, we weren't planned for these and these won't fit in the narrative. And so they wound up doing a bunch of subplots. So, yeah, I think that the happy medium we always try to figure out is to know where you want to go, but be open to the fact that it might take you a couple different places. I think the really pernicious thing is when a show sort of very much implies in that first season or two, oh, yeah, we have a plan. And as a professional showrunner, I've watched those shows and thought, you have no plan. I know exactly what's going on here. You did not think you were going to get picked up, or you thought you had a different ending, and you're vamping until you figure something out. But I think that, you know, the thing that we've kind of overcompensated in American television, this desire for serialization, for like, you know, a continuing story, there's nothing wrong with the story that just ends every episode, too. And I think that's kind of a rebalancing you're seeing now, where you're starting to see TV series go, oh, we can do a story of the week, and we can have it tied to the overall story and try to find that balance.
You have been in the situation where you've had shows both on network and on cable. Is it a different mindset going in when you're working with the suits of a network as opposed to cable, where it's maybe a little more loose?
Depends entirely on the executive. I have worked for great executives in broadcast. I've worked for not great executives in cable. And that's why the really good ones, you see them tend to go from job to job, because you desperately want that person to run your network. The big thing for broadcast is the time challenge, is the numbers are out week to week. We live or die by this week's numbers. Where cable, more and more, it's like, look, your first season. If it works or doesn't work, we won't bring you back. But at least make your 10 or 13 and tell your story. And just the difference in that is the same pressure. They still have numbers. But just the difference in that pacing and that schedule allow you to do more interesting work. And there's a reason cable is generally more interesting than broadcast right now. It just is. You know, it's different working conditions.
Interesting concept and stories indeed. Before we let you go, I got to ask if you can tell us, what are you working on these days?
Two things. I'm working on an adaptation of the Name of the Wind fantasy novels by Patrick Rothfuss, The Kingkiller Chronicles. We're going to bring it to television at the same time they do a feature film series, so we'll be in parallel with that. And exactly how we're doing that is a really cool concept. We'll probably be announcing at Comic-Con this summer. And then also I'm writing a TV show about Shanghai in the 1930s for Sony Television to do international. So it's one big fantasy thing and one historical epic. So I like to think I've tagged the bases. I've done a Conan Heist show, I've done a magic show, I'm doing a historical show, and now I'm doing a fantasy epic. So I like to make sure I can't be either I'm a jack of all trades, master of none, or I've managed to keep from being stereotyped. I'm not sure which.
Well, you're always very busy, so I'm glad we have the opportunity sometimes to touch base and talk with you. And I thank you very much for enlightening us a little bit on the whole idea of what a showrunner does and how they work. Thanks for being on the program, John.
Always a pleasure, Peter. Take care.
Screenwriter, television producer, and director, and yes, showrunner, John Rogers. Always a pleasure to talk to John, and we'll keep you posted on news about his upcoming projects. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
Still to come on the program, we'll talk about mental illness with the author of Two Sides to the Story, Living a Lie. Plus, we'll also talk about small, or at least smaller, homes. Because now houses are huge, gigantic. But we'll talk to the author of Small Homes, The Right Size. Plus, we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And lots more Stuff File news here on a program that is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio success. You can also find this show on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get back to the stuff. When a Hawkins County, Tennessee sheriff's deputy tried to perform a routine traffic stop, the car sped off rather than pull over. The deputy couldn't safely pursue the vehicle, but shortly afterward, a police officer in Church Hill spotted the vehicle in town. The car was found parked in a driveway, and the resident of that house was outside. The resident said a man and a woman had rushed into her house, saying the cops were chasing them, so she ran outside. Police went in and sure enough found the couple. 26-year-old Heather Leanne Caldwell was hiding in bed with the covers pulled over her. 33-year-old William Ashley Davis was hiding between the mattress and the box springs. Police also found why they fled. They had various drugs and drug sales paraphernalia, and Davis's driver's license had been revoked. They were arrested on various felony and misdemeanor charges. You know, they never have driver's license, or at least a valid driver's license, in any of these stories we share. Happens every time. Or out of date tags, whatever the case may be. But clearly, they must believe that this arrest was unfair because, you know, every child understands the rules. If we can't see you, you can't see us. I mean, seriously, hiding in a bed with the covers pulled over her or hiding between the mattress and the box spring? Really? Really? Anyway, moving right along, because that story, as far as they're concerned, they have no logic. But this next story, please follow along to this one because, folks, there's some real logic that borders on ingenious in this story. Are you ready? India's Supreme Court approved an order recently that forced bars and liquor stores to close down if they were located less than 500 meters or 1,640 feet from state or national highways. Now, India Times reported in April that the Aishwarya Bar in North Paravur, Kerala, is still legally operating at its old location, even though it is clearly within the 500-meter restricted area. The owner explained that since he owns the land behind the bar, too, he has constructed a serpentine wooden maze in back and front that requires any entering customer to take the equivalent number of steps it would take to walk 500 meters. And believe it or not, a tax office official reluctantly accepted that arrangement. Okay, that is mind-blowing. That's the kind of thought process that Captain Kirk would have appreciated. That is so Kobayashi Maru. And Trekkers, you know exactly what I mean, don't you? Yeah, it's so Kobayashi Maru. Anyway, police say a Pennsylvania man repeatedly called 911 while intoxicated because he was seeking conversation. Pennsylvania State Police say 51-year-old Larry Kaiser first called at around 10:30 p.m. Friday because he wanted to speak with a police officer. He said there was no emergency, Kaiser called five more times, leading police to show up at his home in North Whitehall Township after midnight. The man told officers he drank several beers because he was upset about a family situation. Troopers told Kaiser not to call 911 again unless there was an emergency, and he said he wouldn't call again. Troopers say he called 911 the minute after officers left. Kaiser has been arrested and is facing charges that include intentionally calling 911 for other than emergency purposes. Well, you know, I'm guessing he'll be able to talk to the police all he wants now, since he's been, you know, arrested. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, you know how you're not supposed to be using a handheld phone while driving, or texting while driving, or shaving while driving, or anything else that might be considered a distraction while you're behind the wheel? Well, let's just add shooting up to the list, shall we? A Muncie, Indiana man told police he was injecting heroin when he ran into a U-Haul trailer, causing a serious crash in Henry County over the weekend. The crash happened just before 9 p.m. Saturday on U.S. 35. Deputies with the Henry County Sheriff's Department say Chadwick Smith's vehicle crossed the center line and struck the trailer that was being pulled behind a West Virginia man's vehicle. He then struck a tree and a fiber optics box before coming to rest in someone's yard. Smith told deputies he was on his way home to Muncie from Dayton, Ohio, where he had gone to purchase heroin. He said he had been shooting up while driving and had nodded off before the crash. Police recovered a hypodermic syringe along with the drug in his vehicle after the crash. Smith has been charged with possession of a narcotic drug, unlawful possession of a syringe, driving while intoxicated, and public intoxication. Well, at least he wasn't texting. Thank heavens for small mercies, huh? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Chris Nyme is a mental health advocate, illness survivor, author, and teacher. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2001. Subsequently, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder. He has written his memoir called Two Sides to the Story, Living a Lie. And he joins us on the line right now from Ottawa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to do this. Right off the bat, talking about the subtitle of your book, it's called Living a Lie. Why Living a Lie?
When I started teaching in 1998, I had the world right in front of me. I had come out of University of Western Ontario, a graduate on the dean's list. I had scholarships. I was president of the student council of all kinesiology at Western. So when I left school and got into teacher's college, I had everything going for me, and the world was basically there in front of me to take as far as what I wanted to do with my life, what I wanted to accomplish. I had visions of a family. I had visions of, you know, a really good, cushy job. I had visions of having children. And I started teaching in 1998. And at the time, it came up on me with quite a surprise. But illness started to really take over my mind during those years. For 2 years, I had these terrible feelings that went from very, very low, depressive feelings where I'd come home and I was tired and I didn't have the energy and I couldn't do stuff, to maybe a few weeks later feeling an overabundance of energy and activity where I would stay at school till 10 at night and I was working like a fiend. It was wild. I had so much of this euphoria. But in those low times, I just decided that maybe it'd be best that I don't tell anyone, because I was worried about my career and I was worried about what people would think if I was to bring up how I was feeling. So for a good 2 years working as a teacher, I hid a lot of secrets that had to do with mental illness as to what I was feeling and what I was experiencing to protect myself. I wore a mask basically to show people that I was Chris Nyme. I was strong. I was powerful. I had the smile. I had the looks. and I could do anything I wanted. And the way I was feeling was not going to be revealed because I didn't want people to bring me down or say, well, you must be sick or you're not capable. But it wasn't until I left teaching full-time when the sickness really kicked in and started to push me around, and I eventually went on my major manic episode and then down into my major depression. And it was from there on in that my family and I made an agreement that we would keep everything hidden, because if I was to go back into my profession of teaching, I felt that I needed to hide what I was dealing with. Mm-hmm. I knew I was a great teacher, but people wouldn't see that if they saw illness first.
As I mentioned, you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2001. Is that something that was merely a diagnosis, an answer to what you were feeling, what we're going through, a discovery at that point, or was it something that you had been going through for a long time before that, and it was only diagnosed as bipolar in 2001?
I started to experience ups and downs when I turned about 18. It was just before leaving for university. I had my first, we called them episodes, where I just was completely out of the ordinary for me. I was thinking differently. I was agitated. I was angry, and it was so unlike me. So when I went to university, I got caught up in the extreme, you know, excitement of university, which really took the waves of my bipolar to highs and lows that, you know, took me from being this, you know, leader of everyone and running the show and being this super guy to other times where I was locked in my dorm room, lying in bed, and no one knew that I was struggling. And actually, that first year, I ended up leaving at Christmas as a Christmas grad, which is just sort of the term that people use when someone leaves school, not knowing why, not understanding why, because these great feelings felt so good that I didn't think I was dealing with illness. I just thought, wow, I must be some special guy. I can feel this way, and I can do all these things that others can't, and I must be chosen, I must be special. But then when the depressions hit, I just wondered what was going on. But when it did hit in its full in 2001, it was quite evident in my major high that things were really off. When I started to, spend money carelessly, I had so much energy that I was, hugging people I didn't know and meeting every person that I could in a restaurant. There were times that I felt I was chosen by God to take over the world and make this world a better place. And my thoughts just took me all over the place, where I thought I was building big businesses that were going to make billions of dollars. And then finally I came down into my low in 2001, July, and it was the worst experience of my life, where I was in my parents' basement for over 2 months, in the dark, would not leave the basement. I had to be prescribed light from my doctor, which was a 5-minute walk upstairs and then back down for the day. So, yeah, I did experience it before 2001. We just didn't understand it then, and I hid a lot of those things from even my family. But in 2001, when it really came in full force, it was clearly evident that I had bipolar disorder.
Well, let's go back a bit. You talk about when you were a student and what you were going through at that time. And now you've written this book, Two Sides to the Story, Living a Lie. You're a teacher, you're a motivational speaker. You go around talking about this. I'm sure somebody comes up to you and asks the question, how do you know, going back to that experience when you were a student, how do you know what you're going through is a mental illness and not just normal anxiety of growing up and experiencing new things?
Yeah, I know, it's a very good question. I think when I went through high school, because mental illness was so frowned upon in those days, that even when I left swimming and baseball and football, I was actually invited to play university football at Western. I was invited that year, and they actually won the Vanier Cup, but I made an excuse because of obsessions I was having to not go and put school first. But even during those times, there was so much anxiety in even mentioning any of this to people. You know, when I brought up stuff to my parents, we talked a lot, but there was a lot of things that I didn't understand that were happening within me that I just didn't want to talk about at that time, because it was such a, you know, a weird thing to talk about mental health. People just didn't. It was one of those topics that stayed hidden. Nowadays, we're starting to talk more. We're starting to bring it up more. Kids are realizing that it's not their fault that they have a disorder. It's not their fault at all. It's a genetic thing. It comes through, or it's a circumstantial causing a genetic to trigger. And we're trying to tell these kids now that you need to talk, that you need to speak up. Because I really believe if I spoke up more in high school and university, I could have, you know, gone on a different track completely and possibly avoided the major low and the major high that I did that just ripped my life apart and basically was a decade climb trying to get back my life, trying to be the Chris Nyme that I knew I could be while watching my friends move on and have babies and have, you know, jobs and big houses, and here I am just struggling along. So the message I try to tell kids now is you need to be able to talk. You need to be able to speak up, because you're only going to get help if you speak up. And you can change the whole course of your life by speaking up and realizing that the climb to healing can be a lot steeper if you hide these things and you don't tell people. And now, with the message I share about hope and healing, I'm giving kids the opportunity to say to themselves, you know what, I am struggling, but there's nothing wrong with that. I'm going to get the help that I need. Because if I don't get the help that I need, I'm going to struggle. And if I struggle, I'm not going to be able to accomplish the things that I want to in my life.
Well, you've written this book now. We've got just about a minute, but I do have to ask, how are you feeling now? How are you doing now?
You know, it is really night and day as to where I've gotten to. I've come so far in my healing to the point where now I'm sharing my story and influencing lives and researching things and being part of the mental health field in what I do. Writing changed my life. Picking up that pen and starting to write my story, it gave me a whole new outlook on my life. It was a whole change in purpose and meaning. It gave me a reason for what I went through. The suffering was not going to control me, because I now had the tools to be able to move on. So I try to pass that on to any people that are struggling or going through things. Healing does happen, and that's my message. I pass that message everywhere. Healing can happen, but it begins with the individual saying, I want to make this happen.
A very good message indeed. Thank you very much, Chris, for being on the program with us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chris Nyme, author of Two Sides to the Story, Living a Lie. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0407, and you'll find links to Chris's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It would be hard to find any industry in America that has benefited more from a lack of government regulation than the ride-sharing business. Companies like Uber and Lyft that didn't even exist a few years ago are now transforming the way that millions of people get from point A to point B. And they're doing it by operating outside of the regulatory system that has governed the taxi business for decades. Soon after, millennials and Generation Xers helped kickstart this new industry by using apps on their smartphones to find a ride rather than by calling a taxi. The convenience offered by ride-sharing became obvious to their parents, too. Let's be fair, not everyone likes these changes, though. Some traditional taxi cab drivers who are stuck in the old system have filed lawsuits demanding government bailouts. One lawsuit recently made it all the way to the Supreme Court in Georgia, but it was rejected unanimously. That's bad news for an old monopoly, but good news for consumers. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, the best thing since sliced bread.
No loafing here.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about small homes. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I got a few more Stuff File news stories that I want to share with you here on a program that is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, okay, folks, tell me if you see the irony with this story. Warwick, Rhode Island police are looking for a surveillance camera thief on Friday. According to Warwick police, the suspect entered a Walmart on May 25th, where he allegedly stole three surveillance cameras by hiding them in his jacket. How do we know this? He was caught on surveillance cameras. The suspect is described as an older white male and was seen getting into a silver Dodge Grand Caravan with New Hampshire plates. Believe it or not, they're still looking for him. I'll bet no one is stealing stuff at his place, though. Yeah. And finally, back in the day when I graduated from kindergarten, you know, back when the earth cooled, my parents, nor none of the others in the neighborhood, or the entire hemisphere for that matter, thought it was necessary for me to be part of a kindergarten graduation party. But times have changed. Also, sometimes six-year-olds get into scuffles with each other. In that regard, times haven't changed. However, adults should be, you know, adult about these kind of things when they're dealing with it. Police say a Pennsylvania man was hosting a kindergarten graduation party for his son and several other children when he was fatally shot. Witnesses tell state police that a fight or rough play between the victim's six-year-old son and another six-year-old led to an argument between adults at a Wednesday evening party in Hanover Township near Wilkes-Barre. Authorities say the argument ended with 27-year-old Tremaine Jameson of New York City shooting 29-year-old Devin Brown in the head. Online court records show troopers have charged Jameson with criminal homicide and possessing a prohibited weapon. Police say Jameson lives in Harlem and that authorities are now searching for him. Okay, back to my original point. Who really needs a graduation party for a six-year-old, unless you're concerned that he's already peaked and this might be his last shot at a ceremony? And more importantly, who brings a gun to a kindergarten graduation party? Ooh. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? When it comes to home ownership, a current popular trend in having a little piece of land that you can call your own is to have, literally, a small house. Small homes are less expensive, use less resources, and are more efficient to heat and cool, and cheaper to maintain and repair. Lloyd Kahn is the author of Small Homes, The Right Size, a book where 65 builders share their knowledge of building and design. Lloyd joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. This idea of small homes, it's now become very, very expensive to get a larger home. And we here in North America, particularly in Canada, do seem to like our large houses. So is part of what's happening now, this revolution with small homes, is this part of changing a mindset both for not only economic reasons, but also for the planet?
Well, I think it's both things. The average American home, probably the average Canadian home is maybe the same. It's about 2,700 square feet. And maybe 5 or 6 years ago, the so-called tiny house movement began, which was getting down to maybe 200 to 300 square feet. And the important thing about it was that things were getting smaller. And so our book is in between the typical large home and the tiny home. In the book, the homes are between 400 and 1,200 square feet.
I'm still aghast at the idea that 1,200 square feet is still considered small.
Well, you know, I was in a bookstore last night looking at magazines, and there was a magazine, McNally Robinson Bookstore in Winnipeg, and there was a quite a good magazine selection, and there was a magazine called Small Homes. So I looked at it, and the average homes in there were like 2,500 square feet. So, you know, some people haven't got the message. And it's really important for people, especially of modest means, that that homes be smaller. And in our we did a book called Shelter in 1973, and the heart of the book was small homes. We drew up the plans for five different little houses where we drew every stick of wood in the house so that people could understand it and hopefully they would be able to start building themselves.
Now, I did mention the word mindset a few moments ago, and I'm just wondering how important is that terminology? Because I seem to get the impression whenever I see television shows or any stories about small homes, the smaller the home, the more the person who is going to appreciate that home seems to be someone who is a little more adventurous and outdoorsy. And that doesn't necessarily translate to everyone.
No, I think the things that you're seeing are what they call tiny homes. I mean, we did two books on tiny homes, so I'm well acquainted with the theory. And and so the tiny homes are, we did a book called Tiny Homes, and we then did a book called Tiny Homes on the Move, which was about nomadic homes on wheels and in the water. And so I had a lot of, you know, I gave a lot of thought to that, and it seemed to me that it's a great idea in the sense that things are getting smaller, but two people, say, living in a 200, 300 square foot home has got its problems. I mean, maybe if they each had a tiny house, it would work better. But we're sort of in between here. We're like Goldilocks. So it's, you know, it's just right, not too small and not too large. But I think that the people who are in the tiny homes movement, I mean, there's a couple of TV programs on tiny homes, and they do tend to be more adventurous, and they tend to be younger, and they some of them just want to simplify their lives, and in some cases they put them on wheels so they can move them around, and so it really is a movement now. But I think that more realistically, a small home is going to suit more people than a tiny home.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, the book has 65 builders share their knowledge of building and design. When you design a home that is a small home, as the subtitle of the book says, the right size, is there a different, and I'll use that term again, mindset. Is there a different mindset on the part of the builders to create such a home, or is it just a smaller version of something that's bigger?
Well, I think the problem with, I mean, all the builders I know, I've worked as a carpenter for about 10 years. All the builders I know now, they're basically working for millionaires. So it's kind of difficult for a builder to make a living building modest homes. Wherever the impetus comes to build of whatever size, whether it's from the builder or from the prospective homeowner or the architect, that's a consideration. I think that probably, though, that people are, you know, looking for, and it's a mindset. I mean, because it is as opposed to just having a huge house, you probably want to save money. And there's basically a housing crisis going on right now. And I mean, I'm doing probably my 11th and 12th bookstore appearances tomorrow in Toronto, and everywhere I go, people are, you know, the rents in San Francisco are $3,500 for a studio apartment, and so extremely high rents, and then or getting locked into a bank mortgage for 30 years are things that I don't know if people even have to be very adventurous to not want to, you know, to fall into those categories. So there's the impetus for small homes, and then there's building from scratch is one thing, and then another thing is to find small, and probably it may be more realistic than what we were trying to do in the 60s, which was find 10 acres in the wilderness and build a log cabin. Is that in towns and cities there are small homes, and that are maybe a bit run down, and you can get them for a, you know, for a modest price and fix them up. And the advantage of that is you've already got water and electricity and sewage, so you don't have to start from scratch. So there's and then one other option is two families buying a home in a city and making it into a duplex, and that's something that's been done. And so they're in doing that, you cut the, if you can get along with the other family, you're cutting your costs in half by doing that.
I think of the term small homes, and I think back to post-war here in this country. There are a lot of homes that were built after World War II for the returning vets, and the same was done, of course, in the United States. And those homes weren't necessarily the largest houses in the world, yet there were people who raised families in those homes, and back then, families usually was 3, 4, or 5 kids.
Yeah, I mean, a guy came up to me at the bookstore last night, and he said, we have an 1,100 square foot home, and we raised 2 kids, and it was fine. It seemed to us like it was plenty of room. And he said, now that the kids are gone, we're thinking of partitioning off part of the house for heating purposes, so that it is a mindset. I think it's a, you know, and it also depends on how much stuff you have, and so that I would hope that and then one other thing is that there are cities. Vancouver is one of them, also Portland, Oregon, and Santa Cruz in California, that have enacted ordinances that make it easier to build a small house in your backyard, say for your mom who might be 93 years old and you can't afford $50,000 a year for a rest home. And they're relaxing the rules somewhat so that you don't have, it's not like you're starting a new house. And California, now the statewide is looking at this problem. It's kind of like all of a sudden in the last year, people are recognizing that this is a problem, that all these people can't afford rent, they can't afford to buy a new house. And I just have been in Toronto for an hour now, and I was talking to my landlady at the Airbnb where I'm staying, and you know, and there's a house next door to hers that sold for $850,000, and it's falling apart. And so, and part of that, and then the problem, and especially in Vancouver, is that very wealthy people are buying houses and then just as speculation and not even living in them. So yeah. it's a growing problem. What people are going to do?
Looking at the book, and we've just got just about a minute now. Looking at the book, there are some great pictures, obviously on the cover. But I would be remiss by not mentioning there are great pictures and ideas that are contained within the book. Lots and lots of pictures. For whom did you exactly write this book for? Whose attention were you trying to draw with this book?
Well, I think people like me, maybe, or people that like the sort of stuff. I mean, we've been doing these books for 45 years, so we've got people that are of the same sort of mindset, and there are all kinds of homes in the book. Some of them are very artistic and aesthetic and creative, and some of them are quite plain. A bunch of them came in from Mother Earth news readers. So they're in parts of the country where I don't normally get, like in Kentucky and Oklahoma and Missouri. So those people, I mean, you know, just people who want to have things be smaller. And we gathered material from people contacting us, and we probably takes 2 or 3 years to gather material for a book like this.
Well, the book is called Small Homes, The Right Size. It's written by Lloyd Kahn. It's a beautiful book and an informative book. And I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Lloyd Kahn, author of Small Homes, The Right Size. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0407, and you'll find links to Lloyd's blog and also to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now, boys and girls, for the moment you've all been waiting for. Yes, it's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the day.
Colin Ayres and Mervyn Chong didn't want their faces spotted, so they put on masks and balaclavas and hoodies. No helmets, though. They wouldn't fit over all that other stuff. Nevertheless, they rode their moped around the jewelry store they wanted to plunder, Ayres holding a pickaxe with his legs. All this made them so conspicuous that four Ramsgate, England shoppers called police. When the authorities arrived, the 28-year-old Ayres drove the moped into a lamp pole, making their capture easy. Chong was given a 2-year sentence. Ayres' lawyer asked the judge not to punish him for his stupidity, but the judge sent the bungler to prison for 2 years, too, plus a month for having to be arrested again instead of showing up to be sentenced. Wow. It appears that Ayres just doesn't get it, because why, oh why, would he want to drive around a jewelry store with his buddy, both wearing masks, balaclavas, and hoodies, while carrying a pickaxe between his legs? And when captured and tried, why would he not show up for sentencing? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0407. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0407. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.